Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Be Good, Rewatch It. Today, we're rewatching Event Horizon, Paul W.S. Anderson's schlock horror sci-fi masterpiece from 1997. I'm Danielle Riendo, and joining me today is my brother in horror, Patrick Klepek.
This is already off to a rough start. It's Be Good and Rewatch It, please.
I remember that.
You're not re-recording it. You have to live with this. This is just how it goes. You're not the only one. Austin has continually fucked this up, but I'm here to, you know.
It's because I think everybody is doing a different acronym for it, like BGARW versus BGRW. So it's like the whole thing.
Well, I think that's because technically in acronyms, you're not supposed to do, often you don't do like the and,
right,
or like in. Or the. So then BGRW would be, that's my preferred acronym. But hey, you know, I'm not going to, it's 2019. Yeah. Do what your acronyms how you want. I'm not going to stop you. But
that's right.
I will correct you if you get the name of the podcast wrong. That's the one line I'll draw.
I put it, it's now in all caps. The and is in caps now, even more so than anything else. And if we're off to a rough start, that's okay. Because Event Horizon also had a rough start. Let's put it that way. So I picked this movie. I'm going to tell you the story of why I picked this movie. I became aware recently of a podcast that I truly love. And this isn't a waypoint because it just inspired me so much to do this movie and then now go and listen to so much of this podcast. But it's called the Faculty of Horror Podcast. And it's two academics who, it's not an academic podcast, but it is two sort of like film studies people, like academics, who are watching horror movies and having these incredibly like punchy, good, like amazing criticism, tight, but just, oh my God, everything you want in a fucking podcast. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And they did one on Sunshine and Event Horizon. So of course, naturally, in the last week, I have watched Sunshine and Event Horizon. Event Horizon being a movie, I'm sure, and I definitely want to hear your history with it. But I have not seen this movie until this week since about 1997. I was 13, maybe it was 98, because I do remember seeing it sort of like at home. It was on TV or we rented. I think we rented it. We rented a video cassette from Blockbuster Video. We brought it home and it scared the living shit out of me, this movie, Event Horizon. And it's always had like a mythos to me in my head ever since this event, you know, like 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago, where I was like, man, is that a good movie? Is it? Because I remember it being really scary when I was a very young teenager, but is it actually scary? Is it actually good? And that's sort of my history with it. But I definitely want to hear your history with it, because I know you also have a storied history with this movie.
I guess so. It depends on what you mean by storied. I don't remember when I first saw this film. I don't have like an origin point. I can think of, I have like several competing theories. One is that I was a huge fan of another film directed, the movie that Paul W.S. Anderson, who weirdly, just side tangent, you're one, like if you watch Event Horizon, I don't know if they corrected this on the Blu-ray, but he's credited as Paul Anderson, not Paul W.S. Anderson. And so I was reading an interview with him doing some reading before recording this podcast, and someone asked about like, well, hey, some films you're credited as Paul Anderson, some films as Paul W.S. Anderson. And so that is because of some wrinkle in the, I believe the Writers Guild or the Directors Guild, where if you're the writer director, like it has to be Paul W.S. and like there are like, there's a specific, because there are multiple Paul Andersons,
yes,
like the WS is invoked in like specific scenarios
based on some form of crediting. It's just, it's not, at first I was like, did he just gotta get pretentious as fuck after what, Mortal Kombat and Event Horizon? Then he went on to make Resident Evil movies and was like, right. Gotta put my stamp on this shit. Gotta put a WS in the middle or else people aren't gonna know this is mine. And it's like, no, actually it turns out it's like a director's guild or something, like a specific clause based on like Paul Thomas Anderson and Wes Anderson. Like, I don't know. It's just, anyway, so that's, interesting aside, because this movie, when I was watching it, opens with Paul Anderson. I was like, what are you? Everyone thinks him as Paul W.S. because he, you know, people forget once the Resident Evil movies took off that, like, he had done some of this other stuff. Like, in Mortal Kombat, Event Horizon are pretty far back in the
95
catalog.
95 and 97. More than 20 years ago. At this
generational
point,
differences. Generational audiences coming to meet our boy Paul Anderson at different points in life. And so it's possible that I was obsessed with Mortal Kombat and then saw this, but it's like unlikely that when I saw Mortal Kombat, I was like, I need to see more from the director of Mortal Kombat. Like that just seems, and I don't want to give myself that much credit because I don't think that's true. I think what's more likely, because I definitely have seen it before, and I've seen it multiple times since then, but I want, so like, I was attracted to all sorts of different kinds of horror films as a kid, but it was more like accidentally horror. So it's like, you know, you'd see Jaws or Aliens, but that just kind of happened. It was just happenstance. Those were just movies I ended up seeing because they were on TV or, you know, pull it off the shelf of an older brother or sister at someone's house. I was like, we're going to watch this R-rated film that we're not supposed to.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't until... I started building a catalog of those things over time. Like, I was attracted to games like Silent Hill and Resident Evil. I didn't identify as a horror fan, but probably subconsciously, like if you'd look back at like the things I was playing, you'd be like, hey, you seem to have like an interest in horror. But it wasn't until college that I started watching a lot of like the AMC movie marathons that around Halloween. And so AMC, before they became, you know, known as like for Mad Men and The Walking Dead, they were just the American Movie Channel, and like you just put on if you like wanted to watch some random film. And in October, they would largely turn into a horror station, and they would just be playing like Halloween 1 through 8, you know, over and over, like back to back. And so often I would just sit down, like before going out or like after coming out from the bars, like I just watch whatever was on AMC, and I got really into Hellraiser. And then around the same time is when I met my now wife, and she had a long history with horror. And so we would spend a lot of time going to the local movie theater, or not movie theater, local like a movie store, and just like go to the horror section. And just, it was really well curated. It wasn't just like some junk. Like, it was people that like, the library was made by people who loved genre films. And so we would just kind of go through the horror section, picking stuff based on either we'd heard about it, or she had seen it, or I'd been curious about it, or like, old school, The Cover is good, and I want to see what this movie's about. So I know that's when I saw it again, and that was tied to me falling in love with Hellraiser. So I think that's what like eventually got me there, was my burgeoning obsession with Cenobites and Clive Barker, then eventually meeting an accidental rewatching of Event Horizon. So I do think my first time I saw it was on AMC, and then that was around the time that I was also watching a lot of Hellraiser films. And so I believe that's where it like lands for me, because I don't think I was like you and saw it. I was definitely not seeing it in the theater. Like, my parents were not taking me to horror films in the 90s. So I'm pretty sure that's where it lands for me.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of love that, though, especially because you're invoking the sort of the video store, which, oh my God, if I miss anything of that era the most, it's probably that. It's probably going to a place that is that curated, especially like a local place. It could be a Blockbuster if you had like an awesome staff there, that kind of thing. But this is just so that kind of movie. This is so perfectly that type of movie. And also there's a lot of Hellraiser overlap, which I know we'll kind of get into as we talk about it a little bit. But sort of just setting up what Event Horizon is. Now that we've done our histories with it, this is very squarely in the sci-fi horror realm. It is definitely a derelict spaceship film, which, my God, do I love a good derelict spaceship film.
Yeah, that's a subgenre of the sci-fi space film, especially in horror. That, not even a subgenre. That is like maybe just the genre.
Right? Yeah. I mean, like, so much of a piece of it. And absolutely. Well, that's also like an entire genre of game, too. The, oh, my God, what happened here? Which comes out of the sort of filmic history, this sort of rich tradition of something went fucking wrong on this spaceship. What went wrong on this spaceship? And it's your job to figure it out. Only, and obviously with film, it is more about the characters themselves and what happened with them and all the themes that we're going to talk about. So very briefly, Paul W.S. Anderson, who now I suppose will invoke the W.S. since it is proper in current times to invoke the W.S. So he was coming off of a massive success in Mortal Kombat. So that was the 1995 movie that everybody loves for its soundtrack and its goofiness and its sort of lighthearted take on, a gory,
yeah, the super serious
game.
Mortal Kombat mythology. Please. Yeah. I did take it very seriously at the time. So, like, that is tongue-in-cheek in a way that, the 10-year-old Patrick would take some umbrage with.
Yeah, I'm sorry, 10-year-old Patrick. I love it, too. Like, let's be clear. I love.
I pulled that out of my
Mortal
ass,
Kombat.
But 1995, that's 10 years old. I was 85, 95. So, yeah, I was 10. Yeah. I definitely saw that movie in the theater. And, like, the final bit when Shao Kahn comes out and the music kicks in is one of the greatest cinematic experiences of my life.
Yes. I mean, that makes me very happy because it is a true delight. So awesome. Yeah, he kind of went into this. He had a lot of freedom. And the conventional wisdom is that he wanted to do something a little darker, which, holy shit, did he ever do something a little darker than Mortal Kombat here with Event Horizon. They made this movie, to keep it super brief, it was a bit of a strained production. They did not have a ton of time, but apparently the mood on set was actually pretty good. People were pretty happy.
He also rewrote the script, I think.
He did.
Right? So,
yeah,
like,
originally... Go ahead.
Some like no-name screenwriter that he's done almost nothing since, and it was more of like a legit just like ripoff of Aliens. Like,
yes,
they go to a rift, and then like tentacle things
yes.
are on the ship.
it was a big tentacle monster, a little bit Eldritch horror, a little bit, you know, just goofy. Goofy stuff. They made it so much darker, as I understand it. I was reading the shooting script the other day, and my God, even the shooting script, what they actually shot and what the original cut of this movie, which was 130-something minutes, was much darker than what we actually see in a very, very tight, actually, something like 95 minutes. I forget the exact running time here, but it's a pretty tight movie. We go in, and it is, to give you something of a plot summary, there's a ship. It was lost 7 years ago, 8 years ago, something like that. And there is a sort of a rescue ship, a lifeboat ship, where their primary job is to go out and do search and rescue missions. And they take this scientist, Dr. Weir, played by Sam Neill, who is a gem in this movie, to go find out what happened. And what happened was, spoiler alert, the ship went to hell and came back and is now alive and also sort of a Cenobite and also sort of hell itself, to keep it very, very brief. And now our characters, our heroes, have to be very heroic in order to not sort of go to lose their minds to the sort of hell dimension. And some of them do and some of them don't. And we have a lot of sort of very heavy themes and some very interesting themes going on in terms of hell, in terms of actually, there's a lot of Hellraiser in this movie. I sort of position this movie as Aliens times Hellraiser. Not that I like meets, but this is actually perfectly that. In terms of setting and in terms of tone and in terms of like just how schlocky it is. I've always thought of Hellraiser as being like a pretty serious movie that rides the line between schlock and like genuine greatness. And I don't think that schlock keeps something from being genuinely great. This is maybe a little bit further on the side of schlock, but it also takes itself pretty seriously tonally and also has a lot of fun. Which I think is very much due to the performances in the movie. So I guess I'm introducing a whole lot of ideas here. But going in your most recent rewatch, was there anything that sort of stood out to you in particular about the movie?
Well, it's a really good B movie.
Yes.
Right? So on Waypoint Radio this week, I unexpectedly gushed about M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening.
Perfect.
Or The Happening, the sequel to The Happening.
Sure.
The Happening. Which is a movie that is tonally all over the place. It's for people who aren't aware, The Happening is a film about the plants in a specific part of the Northeast suddenly releasing a toxin that causes everyone around them to both kill themselves and kill others. It's, you know, sort of a, you know, a climate change metaphor, yada, yada, yada. And there's like these long shots of like billowing trees that are meant to spark menace in your heart. Like, oh no, the trees billowing are coming to get us. And it just doesn't really work. I think it's an amazing misfire. Like, I think it's an incredible film that is worth seeing. I bought the Blu-ray. It just showed up today. I'm holding it in my hand at my desk.
Yes.
That's how much I enjoy it, how bad that movie was. But and then reading interviews with Shyamalan, he said that, well, people didn't really quite grasp that it was like, I was trying to make like a tentpole B movie. And it's you didn't pull it off. Like it didn't work. But I think this movie is like the apex of what you're looking for from a movie that's like pulling in just enough stuff that you could be like, there are themes here, I guess. And it's like playing with stuff, but I mean, at the end of the day, it was the way it was pitched, you know, reading about the production, was it being a haunted house on a spaceship. And as far as that goes, like, I think it is like remarkably effective. Like, I love thinking about the themes and picking up pulling a mythology and stuff like that. And because it's fun to just pick at things, even if it's not necessarily worthy of that much. But I think in terms of like a movie that, especially a movie that was like starting to dip into like the early CG, you know, like this comes a couple of years after Jurassic Park, sort of like the perfect blending of practical effects and CG. I couldn't help but like immediately cringe the moment they get onto the spaceship and you see like soda cups spinning at you. And you're just, and like the obligatory, they go into like an engine room where the hyperdrive, the thing that lets the ship travel through space and time. And like, there's like all this CG, like oil, like gooping around, and like constantly the characters have to interact with it. And the goop has to like fly at the camera and you're like, ugh. But it is a movie that is like largely grounded in practical effects. And I think like, I'm surprised how much it remains aesthetically evocative, because most of the most extreme scenes of like, of violence and gore are flash cuts. Like, the movie still manages to leave a lot to your imagination, or a lot of, you know, I mean, these days you can like pause and frame through things, but you know, in, you know, the old days, like if you're watching like a VHS, like you're gonna have a hard time like parsing through like the compilations of violence that are kind of like passed at you at various points of the movie. So I guess the long version of it, or the short version of it, is that I was surprised how well it holds up as like a really fun roller coaster ride. And if anything, that underscores how good, because sort of like how good it actually is, because a movie from that era still feeling fun and managed to get me on moments that weren't just jump scares that I'd forgotten. This is a pretty good testament to a horror movie from 1997, right? Yeah. Is that what we said?
Yeah, 97. Yeah, I think that's an incredibly good point. This movie is so tight and so tightly wound and so tightly produced. You're sort of thrown right in, sort of along with Dr. Weir, onto this, you know, existing relationships of the Lewis and Clark. That's the name of the ship where Captain Miller, Lawrence Fishburne, another sort of gem in this movie.
He is having a good time just fucking
my God,
chewing scenery. Man, when he says the line, not to get ahead of ourselves, but fuck this ship.
Yes!
Like, you, I mean, at the time, it probably came across, like, I'm wondering how it was received by audiences. Like, because you look at it now and knowing what the movie is, you get a line like that and you're like, hell yes. Like, I mean, this will play into a later point that I know you want to bring up to talk about, like, sort of like relatable characters, because I think this is that's like an instance of part of the reason that this movie works, and part of the reason I think it holds up is related to that point.
Yeah, totally agree. He is having the ride of his life. Actually, I sort of in first watching it, one of the biggest things that came to mind, other than just the believable characters, is like, holy shit, this cast is amazing. It's Lawrence Fishburne. It's Sam Neill. It's Jason Isaacs who is like, you know, famous for. For a variety of things, but also being the sort of the captain on Star Trek Discovery. Jolie Richardson is Lieutenant Stark. She's from Nip Tuck. Like, she's an incredible actress. Kathleen Quinlan, who had just won an Oscar at this point for Apollo 13, for being
Sam
Maryland
Neill's
Lovell.
2 years off of Jurassic Park, so it's like he's also got to be in a position to be like, yo, be whatever you want to be in. That said, like, Sam Neill and Lawrence Fishburne have, like, a long... I've not read interviews where they've professed to this, but, like, based on their filmography, must have, like, a deep appreciation or interest or enjoy being in genre films.
Yes.
Because that is, you know, that is absolutely true for Lawrence Fishburne. It's absolutely true for Sam Neill. I mean, Sam Neill's in everything from, you know... I mean, Jurassic Park is in a lot of ways a genre film.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in The Mouse of Madness and just all sorts of other films. He was also in, right? Same year as Event Horizon. Sam Neill was also, I've always meant to watch this movie. I don't know how I haven't seen it. It was always on my list of, like, walk by it. I need to watch it. The movie Snow White, A Tale of Terror, starring Sam Neill and Sigourney Weaver.
Oh, my God.
please, do you want to get the tagline for Snow White, A Tale of Terror? The fairy tale is over.
Oh.
Which is good. I love that. I love that. I think Event Horizons was Infinite Space, Infinite Terror.
Yes.
Also very good. They don't put taglines like that on movies anymore because people see through them and think they're goofy. I miss that era of movie marketing dearly. I am now going to have to mark up. I'm going to tell Rob Zachney, hey, Rob, the next Be Good and Rewatch It is Snow White, A Tale of Terror, the 1997... genre classic. I'm just not going to claim without having seen it.
Right.
But yeah, like it's, I'm curious. I wonder if that holds up with like Kathleen Quinlan. I'm not familiar with the rest of her filmography, but at least, yeah, Lawrence Fishburne and Sam Neill are. So she was in the Twilight Zone movie.
Yes, she
was. That's right. She was in Independence Day.
Yeah.
Let's see what else. Da, da, da. Event Horizon. The Hills Have Eyes, the 2006 remake, which is brutal, but
oh,
effective.
Yeah. Shit, I didn't realize that. Yeah, she is in that.
She was in the Alexandre Aja 2013 movie Horns with Daniel Radcliffe.
Ooh.
It's hard to figure out, like, a lot of actors and actresses end up doing genre work because it's cheap, they shoot fast,
yeah.
And they have a chance to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
So, like, I would just be curious how all these actors break down, like, how much is it you just end up in this stuff because it's, like, convenient?
Right.
And it's a check. And how much is this, like, hey, I live and breathe this shit. So,
yeah,
anyway.
For sure. And depending on the production, of course, and the director, they can also be fun to make. Like, accepting James Cameron entirely from any of this, I got the sense, sort of reading a little bit about the making of this movie, that it was actually, again, a bit of a strained production. They really didn't have much time, but that people kind of had a lot of fun with this, that they kind of knew what they were making, like, oh yeah, this is a B movie, okay, we can have a little bit of fun with this, we can enjoy ourselves a bit here, which I think comes through, frankly. Like, there's a tongue-in-cheek quality to this movie that I find so charming and so sort of, it sounds weird to say heartwarming, because this is a movie about hell and hell on a spaceship and hell becoming a spaceship. It's a little unclear exactly what hell's relationship to the ship is exactly, but go with it. But I sort of find this comforting and heartwarming in a very strange way. And I guess it does have to do with my sort of 90s nostalgia and the fact that I live for this stuff. Sci-fi and horror are my favorite genres. I go back and forth between, okay, do I like horror more one day or sci-fi more the other day? So when they collide, and when they collide successfully on any level, even if it's not, you know, a masterwork of the genre, like Alien,
yeah, why
or something,
choose?
But...
Yeah. It's like pizza. Yeah, sci-fi horror is like pizza. It's like, I mean, it's not good pizza, but like, shit, man. It's pizza.
Yeah,
like,
it's
I'll eat
delicious.
It.
It's delicious. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, it's, oh my God. I had so much fun watching this again. And I guess one thing I do want to talk about a tiny bit in terms of themes is that I do think it's worthwhile talking about themes and pulling things apart, even though it's like a populist piece of schlock, right? Of course it is, and I think that's what it wants to be, and, you know, the director himself knows that's what he wants to make. But a lot of times, this sort of thing actually conveys cultural messages almost more so than something that we sort of look up upon and treat as like a masterwork of the genre, just because maybe the writers weren't necessarily thinking about it, right? They weren't necessarily like, you know, what would be really great here would be a perfect metaphor for X, Y, and Z. And instead, the metaphors get in there because that's just sort of in the cultural, you know, the jello that we're all sort of swimming in a little
bit.
Yeah,
like reflects the moment in society that it was made in less than a more self-serious sci-fi.
Yeah.
That is like, must live up to the you know, the Star Trek, and like, right. you got to be very deliberate. And that's, you know, not a knock on Star Trek as right. much as like, there's just different approaches to doing that. And sometimes I think you're absolutely right that you actually sometimes find more revealed by things that unintentionally say or reflect things rather than media that is like very much capital S saying something.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The prestige kind of thing. So one thing I wanted to bring up, and then I definitely want to go a little bit more into the characters, but one thing I want to bring up, and this was, I do need to credit again, the Faculty of Horror podcast, which talks about this a tiny bit, but about guilt and morality and hell a little bit, which is fascinating because in the sort of general Christian idea of hell, you need to be a bad person to go to hell. You need to sin. You need to do wrong to kind of go into hell. And in this movie, you don't need to sin. You can just be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And there, hell, here it goes. Justin Baby Bear, who is in one of the most effective scenes in this entire movie that I never forgot one beat of, even from 20 years ago. When I thought about this movie, I thought about Sam Neill without the eyes, and I thought about Baby Bear having his issue in the airlock.
Seeing the dark.
Oh, my God. So all he does is just sort of be in the engine room and sort of inadvertently start up the engine that releases the portal.
And the motherfucker put his hand in the goo.
I mean, he did, but this is not like...
He put his hand in...
Is that a sin?
A couple of times. There's all...
Like...
You are on a spaceship that disappeared for 7 years that you have now been informed is capable of, like, interstellar bending time and space to travel.
Yeah.
And you see a portal of goo and say, I'm going to put my hand in it. There's only two... We can talk about this later, but there are only two instances where the movie loses me.
Yeah.
And, like, that's one of them. And the other, and there's another one later.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fine. These movies, you know, horror is full of contrivances,
sure.
But it's scary enough that like, whatever. But I was like, I mean, there's probably like, they could have come up with a better way to like,
yeah.
just show some, you know, transdimensional voodoo that's like, you know, puts him in a psychosis and then he has to put his hand in there, because that's certainly happening a lot in this film.
Yes.
Anyway, I don't mean to dunk on your boy. You're clearly
I feel bad for Baby Bear
as a character. I feel bad for him too. That Woody gets shoved out of the airlock and blood is like coming out of his eyes. Like, yes. Yeah, don't worry. Yeah, I feel bad for him.
Yeah, I guess the point I'm trying to make is not about the plot itself of the movie, but more like this and Hellraiser have a sort of an idea about hell that is very different from the sort of general Christian morality about hell, in terms of like, okay, in Hellraiser, which again, there's connective tissue here. And I believe there is some sort of connection with Clive Barker, which I know you are the Clive Barker expert here. He did something, some pre-production or?
He was a consultant.
Okay. Okay, cool.
I couldn't find like really, everything I found would like mention vaguely that he was involved
sure.
in like early versions of the script because it had been shopped around a bunch.
Yeah.
You know, so unclear. I wasn't able to find anything from like Paul Anderson where like he never referenced, I couldn't find him referencing Hellraiser. But it seemed, whether it was on purpose or accident or was in Clive Barker's pre-production, I mean,
yeah.
like, it's impossible to not look at the Gravity Drive as just like a sci-fi lament configuration.
Yes.
The box from Hellraiser. And the machinations of like the invoking, are different,
yeah.
like sort of the base level idea between Hellraiser and Event Horizon is being hell, as a real place,
yeah.
Or at least what we would call hell, but you know, may just be some other like trans dimension.
Yeah.
But basically a place where there is sort of evil incarnate that. Is indiscriminate and will torture whatever it comes across. I guess the one difference that sort of a big difference is that in Hellraiser, you seek it out.
Yes.
But some people can solve the box by accident. But like largely Hellraiser is around people who are seeking like the line between pleasure and pain.
Yeah.
And the Cenobites exist to serve that. And then in Event Horizon, it's just another dimension. But Mike, Hellraiser, you can solve the box by accident. That's like a thing. So I don't know. Maybe they're closer than I'm giving it credit for.
Yeah, no. I think there is a lot of sort of shared ideology there and sort of shared DNA there. And just Yeah, in terms of how it works, right? In terms of those machinations and like, you've invoked this hell being or this dimension of evil, or this dimension of the extremes. But in one movie, it is like, I mean, Hellraiser is kink. It is kink as horror, and that's brilliant, and it's fascinating. And, you know, the whole 80s politics of it are also fascinating. Although in Event Horizon, it is a little bit more, there's some kink stuff in here that you don't see much of, but we'll talk about the shooting script later.
Sex stuff is a little different in this one.
It's a little different. It is a little bit more window dressing than, you know, very intentionally evoked. But we do need to take a very quick break. Kato let me know that a while ago, and then I got really excited to talk more about this. But we'll take a really quick break, and then we will talk a little bit more about the characters that make this movie work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so on the nuts and bolts side, I guess we're getting out of hell itself here for a second, if we can get out of hell here for a second. I do want to talk about why this movie works so well, because I think it sounds like you feel like it works really well. And I had a blast watching it and also sort of felt like, oh my God, this is really like tightly produced and tightly made, even though it's very clear in some ways that maybe certain things are rushed. Maybe there wasn't, you know, certain coverage on certain things. It does feel very, very tightly produced, and it does work on an emotional level. And that's due to, you know, both the performances, which, again, this cast is amazing. A lot of really, really stellar character actors. And also just these characters are awesome and great. Unlike the sort of latter day Alien movies, which I am a Prometheus apologist. I think there is. OK, let's put this the way I should put this. I think there are great things in Prometheus. So I accept that one a little bit from some of the other sort of latter-day Alien movies. But there's a lot of just really willfully ignorant people in a lot of this type of movie, right? Like, and some of the pleasure of watching a horror movie about, you know, really ignorant or stupid people doing really stupid things is almost getting a sense of catharsis from watching them be punished, that kind of thing. In this movie, everybody's actually like a professional. They actually care about their jobs. They're actually good at their jobs, and they actually care about each other. They have an interesting dynamic, certainly, but Miller is a really good captain. He, you know, he keeps a fairly tight ship, even though it is clearly a bunch of, you know, space roughnecks in the sort of Alien model. He wants to keep a tight ship. He cares about his people. His greatest shame in his life, which comes out throughout the movie, is that he let a crew member die. Once he had to save the other crew members. So this wasn't like, oh, he killed somebody in cold blood or did something horrible. But he really, really cares about the people under his watch. And that's part of what that gravity to that performance and that gravity to that character is part of what makes this work for me, I think.
Yeah, I when I think about horror films, especially ones in which the setup is largely, it's not about solving, it's more who's the one that gets to escape, and how are the others killed in the process? And, you know, this fuels interest in, you know, the sort of like lurid interest that myself and lots of people have in like slasher movies like Friday the 13th is like just the creativity of like the creativity of the killing and the gore and the way of having fun with the concept of death, like is a huge part of the attraction of those movies as opposed to, you know, compelling characters, but often that's because you've just come to accept the genre has lowered the bar to such a degree that you rationalize, I rationalize, like, well, that's just what it is. And it's like, well, it doesn't have to be that way. And that's often why you find yourself, you know, impressed by movies that put in even just a modicum of effort to give characters decent motivations for the actions that they take. And so, It's like, it's the difference between like relatable and believable. Like, I don't know how relatable the characters are in Event Horizon, but they're certainly like believable characters. Like, they make largely credible actions to the point where like the only times I got frustrated with the film were like when they make so obviously like incredible decisions, right? Yeah. So it's him putting his hand into the goo because don't put your hand in space goo. Like, that's just, you know, this is like that's like Prometheus and Microcosm.
Yeah, for
right?
sure.
It's like, yeah. You know, I'm with you. I love Prometheus. Yeah. I think it's a movie that has a lot of really cool ideas that are undone by just really poor character decisions
yes.
that undermine a lot of the cool stuff that it's playing with. Yeah, just like, you know, run the other way from the ship. I know. I get it. But if you just forget those things. And the other moment in Event Horizon is when Catherine Quinlan's character.
Not Stark. She's Peters, I think is her name.
Peters. Yeah. Yes. Peters. You know, her character, you know, part of Event Horizon is that whatever basically like a life force has infested the ship and has sort of like the ship is now sort of alive. Like it is kind of like, you know, it's not quite explained, which is a good thing. Like the mystery of how this actually works. Is it a demon? Is it just like a Lovecraftian eldritch horror that we don't understand? Like, I love the fact that it doesn't really get into that. It's more just left to your imagination on how the thing actually works. But it can create, it can sort of tap into your mind, pull out your greatest fears and memories, probably the things that mean the most to you. And for Peters, that's, she, like, there's a lot of trauma associated with her son who is back on Earth. It sounds like the jobs that all of these people do are often keep them away from home.
Yeah.
And her son was in, if I remember correctly, it's not explained what accident, but some kind of accident in which her son lost the use of his legs, and, you know, clearly, you know, whatever happened there caused a lot of trauma. And there's one point where towards the end when she should be getting on the ship with the canisters, the CO2 canisters, so that they can go to sleep and make it back to Earth, she sees like what kind of looks like her son running around, and she chases after him like,
I know.
Oh, it's just like a really... For a character who, for characters who are, the deaths of other characters end up being way more justified than hers. Like, it's a really unsatisfying that, like, the one woman, right? Like, the only woman in the film?
Well, no, there's Stark, right? Too, but she doesn't, it's interesting. We could definitely talk about Stark later. She doesn't have much to do in this movie, which is a little weird because she survives. Like, she is a survivor. Right. She's a final girl, Peters basically. Given, go ahead.
And Peters is given a lot of the, you know, she's getting a lot of time in the film to sort of explore her character. So she's given, like, a really, like, that, it bummed me out because, like, there are other ways to, like, kill her off. You know what I mean? Like, there were ways to accomplish what the movie wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I thought it, like, really undermined, like, the character's credibility, even the logic of the film, where it's, like, she trips into a hole and then, like, hits her head. Like, come on.
It's not the best. That's not the best.
But, like, the fact that a movie that is predicated on that in a genre that often takes at face value the characters are just going to act irrationally, and part of the genre is that you're supposed to throw popcorn at the screen and be irritated with them. Part of the reason Event Horizon, I think, holds up is because largely the characters don't act that way.
Yeah. Agreed. And when they kind of do a very similar thing with the character arc with Ware, Sam Neill's character, it makes a lot more sense for him to kind of go completely banana pants here. Like, it is so established that his wife, content warning right here, I should just say that straight up, content warning for suicide. There is actually a really rough scene where he basically relives his wife's suicide, which is extremely traumatic. It is really rough. I was sort of watching this with a close friend, and this scene was playing, and I was like, whoa, fuck. Oh my God. This you know, schlocky movie where there's all this blood and gore and all this wild stuff happening is not going to bother me on any level. But then I watch something that looks like a much more realistic suicide and it's like, oh, fuck, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's played straight. Yeah. That's played very, very, very straight. And so that really, whew, that was a little rough, a little tough, but also.
It feels out of place. It also yes. feels kind of out of place. Yeah. The whole scene feels like, why is there suddenly just a naked woman? Why does Sam Neill have to like put it like,
yeah,
that's also a scene that there's a way to accomplish and communicate what the movie wants to say about this character's own past and trauma.
Yeah.
Which is that they're, you know, they're a workaholic that put their work above their personal relationships yeah. that seem to contribute in some way to what happened to his wife, or at least he believes that. But it's a weirdly shot scene that's like, I think trying to be erotic, but is not,
I mean, there's a nude like, hot woman. Yeah. Who's in a bath. Like, it's a very like, okay. yeah. It's a little 90s schlock played straight and played serious. And that does feel a little weird. There's actually a deleted scene at the top of the movie. The movie was going to start, or not the first shots or anything, but one of the first scenes with lines was actually Weir talking with an admiral. And the admiral being like, oh, God, I don't know if you're ready for this. You know, you've gone through so much, that kind of thing, with whether or not he should even go on the mission. That was kind of, I think, doing a lot of heavy lifting and establishing that, you know, this poor dude has really been through a lot, and he blames himself and he feels guilty. And this is that does go a long way into that sort of the hell and guilt sort of weight of the movie, if you will. But it is a little weird in the way that was sort of put together. It is, I do think, partially, not to give anybody a pass, because again, it's that's certainly not what I'm going to try to do here. But it does feel very much like that may have been part of the rushed production, or some things there were left on the cutting room floor that maybe could have actually been put back in, even though this is such a tight movie. It's so tight that another 5 minutes of development may not have, you know, really had any negative impact, and actually may have helped to make the character a little bit more believable. But I do generally think that the characters in this movie are pretty great and just go a long way in making it good. I need to shout out Cooper. The character of Cooper, played by Richard T. Jones, is a lot of fun. I don't know how you felt about him, but every time he was on screen, I was like, oh my God, we can take a breath right now, because Cooper is doing his Cooper thing. He's like, he's trying to get laid at the very beginning when they're coming out of the hyperspace, whatever it's called, the crash couches or whatever they call them in this world. He's already trying to get laid. He's having a great time. And like, he's like the rescue technician. So he's like Mr. Cool. He's like Ricky Rescue, Mr. Awesome. So he gets to kind of have a lot of fun and has pretty much all the funny lines in this movie, with maybe one or two exceptions.
He's given the one-liner role. Yeah. Like, there's always usually some sort of character in these films that is the sort of like comedic relief, or, you know, like sort of like the prototypical like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah. Like, you're going to get like some set of cheesy lines. And he gets all of them in this film. Rather than spreading them out, it's just one character.
Yeah.
We don't get a lot of time with him. That's essentially like his function
right.
for the plot. And it would be not great if like, it was like the only black character in the film was just this
right.
guy who's gonna like make the lurid sex joke to one of the few women on the
right.
ship. And then he's also just there to be the comedic relief. But, you know, the film, I think, is able to walk that line a little more successfully because, you know, Lawrence Fishburne is a different black character
yeah.
who is a very, I mean, he gets his own lines to fuck this ship, but that
yes.
works because that works even better because he's not a comedic character.
Right.
Like, he's a dead serious, like no nonsense person who understands the only way to get things done is to make everyone fall in line. And like that is his character. So like when he does like say stuff like fuck this ship, it's so funny because one, he brings so much gravitas to it.
Yeah.
Like he is just such an incredible actor. And even though he's not chewing scenery in this movie.
Yeah.
But he's not necessarily acting like he's in a B movie. Sometimes you get, you know, like Nicolas Cage is very famous for this. Like, you know, an actor who is capable of being a good actor,
yeah.
But when they're in, you know, schlocky or B-movie films or just kind of lesser films in general, they end up kind of leaning into that either by accident or on purpose.
Eddie Redmayne in Jupiter Ascending is maybe my favorite of this.
Yeah, like, and he knows, right, in that case, like, he knows what movie he's in, right? Yeah. He's playing to type. He's playing to the movie that he understands, like, what's going on. And Lawrence Fishburne, like, you know, plays it straight enough that it helps elevate the film because he's just good. So, like, even though we're given, like, precious few moments with any of the characters, like, when he has that moment where he reveals, like, what happened to him and how he, you know, lost one person on a previous mission, like, it, you know, I'm not tearing up, but, like, it's credible.
Yeah.
Like, it lands for, like, for these movies like this that are juggling tons of characters where you only have, like, the briefest moments for, like, background exposition. Like, it helps when you have actors that can take 5 or 6 lines and make them feel like they're several paragraphs. And that's, like, what someone like Lawrence Fishburne does. But yes, I did. I loved the other characters well. Like, goddamn, like the moment he gets fucking spun into space, he's like, why does this always happen to me? And then what he does his oxygen thing and shoots from like what is clearly what, like miles into space and just like, motherfuckers, I'm coming back. If a lesser actor could not make it, ends up working because it's so goofy.
Yeah.
And the fact that the movie pulls off that tone, like, is sort of seems like an accident, but like it works. Like, I totally bought it, and it's fun. It's fun, especially because that happens in the last third of the movie, where, you know, I'd argue the first half of the movie is its most effective, and then the second half is mostly about Sam Neill looking fucked up.
Yeah, that's a big part of it for sure. He tears out his eyes at one point, which is, again, one of the two things I remembered crystal clear from that first time I watched the movie 21 years ago, with Sam Neill in the eyes. And again, one of those really effective moments. So I want to talk a little bit. I'm so excited to talk about this movie, but I do want to talk a little bit about sort of most effective moments, because I know we probably share at least one of them, which happens to be Justin in the airlock. So I'm going to set this up a tiny bit. This is a character, Justin, who he touched the space goo because he's the young guy who's curious. He's a young engineer. They call him Baby Bear, which is, you know, a little bit of foreshadowing. This Baby Bear got his hand and stuck in the honey jar a little bit here. Only instead of honey, he went to hell and he saw hell. And now he's really messed up and he's catatonic for a while. And he kind of wakes from his catatonic state, and he's almost possessed by the ship or whatever entity is sort of at play here. And he goes out into the airlock, and he's about to eject himself out into space, which, of course, if you've watched any sci-fi movie, or this is a real life thing, you can die really quickly in the vacuum of space. You need both pressure and oxygen and enough heat to live as a human being. We're pretty well suited to our atmosphere on Earth, but space is pretty fucking deadly. And he sort of wakes from his stupor at one point while he's still in the airlock, and he starts panicking. And oh my God, the way it's shot, the way it's edited, this like harrowing, intense moment of panic and moment of rescue between him and Miller and everybody else on this ship who is just freaking out. And they're all really, really good about it, right? This is wild. So basically, one thing I love about this scene, other than the fact that it is so intense and it is so scary, is that it's actually really showing great teamwork among these people who are, again, like, we don't get a ton of character work in this movie, but this is one of those subtle things where Peters is a little bit of a den mother, you know, so she's the one talking to Justin, trying to talk him down, and she's doing her best, and she is flipping out, and she's having the worst day of her life, but she's trying really, really hard to talk him down. And Stark and another character are trying to fix the door, they're trying to, you know, get through the door, they're trying to get him one way, and then Miller is in a spacesuit, and he is going to, you know, basically catch him and put him back in and kind of save his life and do the best thing he can do. And he's talking to him calmly. It is so harrowing and so intense. I feel like I remembered it like beat for beat almost from the last time I watched it. It again, across like 2 decades of time and space in my life. And I remembered this scene, and it is, oh my God, it's incredible. I'm really in love with this scene.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a scene of less is more, which is not, you know, for the moments in the rest of the film when it gets sort of excessive for effectiveness sake. Like, this is a movie that's like pretty understated. Like, the tension comes from, I think, some really tight editing. The fact that these space shots with Lawrence Fishburne still look pretty good. Like, that's the kind of thing that could easily, for a 90s film, have been like just atrocious CG that completely takes you out of the moment. And I just don't think that's the case. I think you're right that it works because the characters are playing off one another in some really effective ways. And yeah, I found it like, you know, I was watching it in the daytime with my like drapes drawn, but like I can't, they're not blackout drapes. So I still get plenty of light in my room. And yeah, I'm with you. I think that's, probably the most effective scene in like the movie. Like, if you're talking about like a lot of what the movie ends up being remembered for are like really shocking scenes of, you know, gore and violence and torture, and not, you know, the actual scenes of just like sort of like built tension that don't rely on sort of like shock and awe are kind of few and far between. But that's one of them, and is a really, really good one.
Yeah, it's and there's a way in which it sort of shows how, you know, this crew was better put together, or maybe they were just less affected by, you know, whatever the sort of being or the dimension is, that they are still sort of capable of working together. They didn't devolve into what is going to be part of what I think is one of my other most effective moments. And it's actually a little bit funny, or I think it's a little bit funny, which is when they finally are sort of able to clean up the tape and see what happened to the previous crew. And you only see it in tiny flashes. This is cut up to hell. Sorry, no pun intended. And there I went. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, everyone. It's cut up. It's chopped up very, 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 very sparingly, which I think is actually effective in this case. Although I am a little sad that some of the prosthetic work and some of the like really incredible practical effects work didn't get a ton of due in this movie because of how choppy these scenes are. But there is a scene where the existing crew, the crew of the Lewis and Clark, actually finds the tape, and it's like this blood orgy. And there's you can see in the shooting script what's actually happening, which is wild. Really, really interesting stuff going on there. A lot of sex, a lot of violence, a lot of somebody pulls, content warning for gore, but a guy like pulls his arm into his stomach, or just wild stuff is happening with bodies. And this is all very much lent to the sort of Hellraiser aesthetic. And as soon as the tape stops, Miller just has this moment where he looks around and he's like, we're leaving. It's just this like really great, like, oh my God, we just watched the most fucked up thing. He just looks up. We're leaving. It's the most like dad moment of this whole movie.
And they're going to blow it up. He's like, oh, what's the plan? Like, I'm going to blow this fucking thing to smithereens. Like, we're going to blow this shit up. Like, what else? Like, did you see that tape?
It's great.
Sort of like a lot of the myth around this film is like, it was a complete bomb when it came out. It cost a lot of money because Mortal Kombat made a lot of money. So he was given, Anderson was given like a pretty, I think it cost like $60 million, which is like a lot for an R-rated horror film in 1997. And so when the movie came out, bombed, and then sort of became like a cult classic on tape, as the years went on, has now been sort of like revived as like a pretty deeply underrated, at least for the time, sort of like space horror film. There was like interest in going back and like doing like a director's cut and behind the scenes things, because Anderson says like this came right before people started doing this on every set. He's like, the next movie I made, there were just people on set who were assigned to do this stuff. They were assigned to archive the production. Like, everything else was just sort of happenstance and accident, because there was just no reason to do things like that. VHS tapes didn't come with stuff like that. This only thing that you would see that was in like magazine spreads. And so when they went back, years late, like 10 years later, to try and figure out a director's cut, whereas like, there were a number of cut scenes and then a lot of the gore, which was done like by a second unit. Mm-hmm. So Anderson didn't actually end up shooting a lot of that. That was largely outsourced to a second unit director. They couldn't find it. Like, or what they did find was so damaged, it was beyond repair. They found some scenes in VHS and then like a tape that was discovered in Spain that they thought might have it was then found to be unusable. And so I think like the latest is that Anderson has said, like, it might be out there, but it's going to be an accident if we find it, which is there's a longer way to say, I actually think it's for the best.
Yeah.
That everything is just rapid fire cuts. I think it's just indulgent enough. I think the imagination does more, like Hellraiser is really effective because the effects are really effective. And also the effects have like a purpose, like the, like Hellraiser, you know, based on Hellbound Heart by Clive Barker, like is playing with gore and body horror and sexuality with like very, with intentionality. And,
yes.
And Event Horizon is just doing it for shock. And so, you know, whatever. Like I've watched plenty of movies in which it's just indulgent shock. And that's part of the roller coaster. I've seen a billion of these. Can I be shocked again? Nature of horror films, especially for hardcore fans like you and I.
Yeah.
But I think Event Horizon wouldn't be nearly as effective if it was actually given a chance to do more of that. I think the brief snippets we get, like I like the fact that in the when they get into the main sort of like a deck of the Event Horizon, like there are those like spots in the back where there's just like blood and gore up against the wall that looks kind of like spider webby in a way. Never explained.
Yep.
Why is that there? No idea. And you know what? I don't want to know. Yeah. Like the fact that it's kept mysterious. Like when I've seen screen captures of the individual like torture scenes and like you can see more of it. Like, I mean, it's interesting, but in my head is a lot scarier than actually seeing like the individual scenes of what was happening. So it's like you just described, yes, a man putting his hand through his stomach is gross. But when you're watching that, you're way more, at least I found, way more unnerved by like trying to keep up and like what, turning to the next person, the person next to you, I'm like, what the fuck was that?
yeah.
As opposed to one that was like three times as long that like really luxuriated in it. You know, I don't know that the movie is better for that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I definitely agree. I do think keeping it real tight like this and evoking that sort of thing, as opposed to really just swimming in it without an actual point to swimming in it. Like if this actually really were Hellraiser, if this actually was, you know, you evoke this demon and you evoke this dimension because you are done with vanilla sex. Kink ain't doing it for you anymore. And your name is Frank and it's just not enough, baby. You know, like if there was like a real point to it, then yeah, I would be interested in seeing some of that. But certainly not just for the schlock or shock, I suppose, sort of value to it. I did go and watch the
Schlock
sort of,
or Shock, the name of our horror Waypoints spinoff horror podcast.
Actually, I think, to be honest, we may have done it. We may have done it, ladies and gentlemen, and folks.
Between Lori's and Shock or Schlock, I just have a knack for identifying podcast names.
I'm in it. Yeah, I'm so happy. That makes me, I'm actually like really beaming right now here in our little VO booth. One last point that you have in your notes, Patrick, that I really do want to address before wrapping up here is the idea of movies that traumatize us in our youth and that Event Horizon is that for a lot of people. That is sort of something people like our age, you know, like earlier or mid 30s who may have saw it at a very young age, you know, young teen, you know, maybe you were just getting into horror or, you know, your parents.
Did you watch the trailer for this movie, Danielle?
Yeah, it doesn't quite
convey anything about, like, it says, like, they're going to go find a creepy ship.
Yep.
But, like, fucking nothing about the Hellraiser set up by torture scenes. It's not even hinted at. Not a clue what kind of movie you're in for.
Yep. So I could conceivably see, like, you know, a parent in the 90s. I mean, my parent in the 90s thought, like, oh, this will be fun. It'll be a dumb, you know, goofy, like, schlocky horror movie. I saw Aliens probably a little too young. And I definitely, you know, did the MGM ride at Disney World very young. So I that alien was my nightmare forever. And so like, I think my parents had so much more leniency with horror than they did with a lot of other R-rated things. Like, oh, yeah, you can see lots of monsters, Danielle. That's fine. But adult themes? Nah. And then, of course, we had a lot of adult themes here on this ship. But yeah, it's a really interesting thing. And a really cool thing, and I suppose part of why I have so much nostalgia for this movie and why I was so pleasantly surprised to come back to it and find, like, again, a really tightly produced movie, like a really, again, like whatever 95 minutes that it is, pretty quick. You're in and out, and you have a friggin' roller coaster ride, and there's not a lot of fat to trim, sort of from the experience. I think that's part of it. I think that really is part of sort of the nostalgia that, like, it was a while ago, but I was in it to win it then, and then watching it the other night, I was absolutely rapt. I was very, very excited. And of course had that sort of nostalgia factor of like, oh my God, the airlock, you know, or oh my God, the eyes. You know, I kind of was saying that to my friend as we were watching it and you know, cowering under a blanket during the movie. I actually did find it pretty scary, at least in a couple of places, which I always appreciate, especially in an older movie and in a movie that is very, you know, CG gore and also something I've already seen. So I don't know if you found it scary at all. I guess I should probably ask that as well, and maybe closer to the top next time. But whether or not you found it scary at all.
Well, you know, like any horror film, it's, you know, hard to be nearly as scared the second time around because you sure. sort of know a lot of what's coming. I think it's still effective. I think, you know, it's still it manages to build tension and shock in a number of places where if you saw this movie, you know, 15 years ago, like it's worth revisiting because enough of it will still land. I think you end up finding parts of it that you still manage to appreciate. But I'm wondering, like, so was this the movie for, so like for me, when I think about like the movie from your youth that haunted you, like it's the movie, like, was this a movie like late? Like, so for, okay, let me set up. So like, the reason I put this in my notes is like reading through, like different articles about this and forum posts of people talking about Event Horizon, like, this was a kind of movie that like ruined people for like a summer or like, like gave them nightmares. Like they saw it at too young of an age and it just like got in them in a way that they were not ready for. Like for me, like there's a couple instances of that. Like I was obsessed with Aliens as a kid. I've talked about these moments before, but like just to recap them, like, I was obsessed with Aliens, so I watched a lot of, like, alien movies. And one that I had watched was Fire in the Sky, which is about this dude that gets abducted in the mountains. And the movie has this really traumatic and still supremely fucked up abduction scene that still – go look it up. Just go look up the abduction scene from Fire in the Sky on YouTube. It's bad. and that – stuck, like, images of that stuck with me for – years. The one that really got me though was the Blair Witch Project, which that came out at a time, it's early internet, things like viral marketing, like that wasn't a thing, but the Blair Witch Project was essentially sort of like the ground floor for the notion of doing that. So like the website for the marketing of the Blair Witch, for people who don't remember, it was pitched as like, oh, this happened.
Yeah.
And whereas like these days, like it's all kind of a wink and a nod. Like they built out an elaborate mythology and history, and I'm sure to older people it was absolutely clear what was going on here. But like for me, like I mean, I guess maybe I knew, but enough of it stuck that like it all just landed for me. It like made it that much scarier that what I. And this is again the beginning of found footage. So you know, you have moments of found footagey sort of filmmaking, like Sam Raimi's, you know, like shots in the woods that are sort of like shaky cam sort of stuff. But like Blair Witch establishes the notion of found footage, or at least popularizes it. And I never went camping as a kid. This movie like really deeply fucked me up and definitely put me off ever camping for years.
Yeah.
And then the stuff that has lingered with me, I mean, other than like the guy staring at the wall at the very end of the film, like that shot will never leave my head. But beyond that, it's the crunching of like leaves and twigs outside of a tent.
Yeah.
You can't see it. It's dark and just crunch, crunch, crunch. And my parents hated paying for AC in the summer. My mom would leave. She just makes us open the windows. And there were nights, it was so hot. And I get it. Money was really, really tight.
Yeah.
Like, they barely afforded the house when they bought it. So, like, I understand. I'm much more sympathetic in retrospect than I was at the time.
Yeah.
But it meant I spent, like, the whole summer after seeing The Blair Witch where, like, the window was open next to my bedroom.
Yeah.
And I would often stay up late at night playing video games, Final Fantasy VII and shit like that. And as soon as I tried to go to bed, I would hear like a raccoon just crunch, crunch. And so for the vast majority, like I'm talking like most nights after the summer after seeing the Blair Witch Project and into the fall, I don't know when it ended. I don't know like when the fever broke. I would just stay up all night till the sun started peeking up and then I would just go to sleep.
Oh my God.
Because summer vacation, I could get away with that.
Yeah.
And like my parents didn't care if I was sleeping in till, you know, whatever. But I, so for almost an entire summer, I was staying up till I could see the sun and I was like, cool. The Blair Witch doesn't come out once the sun is out.
Yeah, you know, she goes to bed.
The common phrase,
yeah.
The Blair Witch don't come out when the sun is out. It's how they promoted the movie.
There is. Oh my God. Yeah, I had.
So that's me. That's mine. Cool. That's, the Blair Witch is mine for that.
I love that. That's so good. That's so evocative. Yeah, I had that with Aliens, and I actually had it from, to recap, because I think I've said this before as well, but I went on the Great Movie Ride in Walt Disney World, MGM Studios at the time, now Hollywood Studios, and there's the Alien from, Alien itself, the 1979 Alien, is one of the sort of tableaus that you kind of go through in that ride, and the alien comes out at you a couple of times, and there's like an audio animatronic alien, and he drips, you know, acid on you. It's water, it's fine. Yes, of course, it's water. But it scared the living shit out of me as an eight-year-old, and I became obsessed with it. And we had a skylight in my bathroom growing up, and I always thought the way the skylight was positioned reminded me of the way that the alien in the ride kind of comes down to, like, feast upon you. Like, that's the idea. And I was just constantly terrified that that alien was going to get me. And then I remember seeing as a young teenager, so this was, like, as an eight-year-old, like, as a very young child, I was very afraid of that thing. And then I saw Aliens, the sequel, when I was like 14 or 15, like probably a little like old enough to know it's not real. But that the scene where the sort of victim who has been harvested and is about to be chest bursted absolutely destroyed me. I remember watching it on like a family vacation at a resort or something and like hiding behind the couch. Like I just like jumped behind the couch like, nope, I'm out. And then, of course, they would come to become like my favorite movies of all time. Like, I think the original Alien is my favorite movie of all time. I don't always have favorites for everything. Yeah, I have a favorite TV show and a favorite movie. And like, you could ask me my favorite food and I'd be like, oh, there's a whole bunch of stuff. But like, Alien is my favorite. And I adore Aliens, the sequel as well. Like, with almost
it's
the
a good
same
pick.
Love. Yeah, I mean,
it's a good pick. I can't argue with it. Like, yeah. I think, I don't know what my I don't know what my favorite movie of all time is. Like, I know my TV show. I know it's Lost.
Yeah. Mine's Farscape.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, Alien's a good pick. Like, like on a given day, like I could give that and feel like, yeah, that's fine. Like, I wouldn't quibble with that.
Yeah.
I had a similar like hide behind the couch experience with the opening to E.T.
Oh, shit.
You know, when Elliot finds E.T. out in the cornfield and E.T. goes,
like, that sound, yes.
So, we'd subsequently watch, that film, I would just hide behind up until, you know, you get the Skittles and then he goes out into the cornfield and it's like, I'll just wait till after them. That and on the opposite end of the spectrum is, goddamn, when they find his like nearly dead white body the river, holy shit. My mom did not know that was coming. She's like, look, Steven Spielberg. What, like
happy children's movie.
A movie about aliens. They're flying in the sky. And she's like, what the fuck, Spielberg? What is this alien
a child
doing?
Near
dying?
Death. Like it's very
like me and my brother are apparently like apoplectic and just like inconsolable. She had to like, you can't look up on the internet like, does he survive? My mom was like, right. If you kill this alien, I think she was gonna go to Hollywood and get some revenge. So
yeah. Ugh. Oh, I love that. I love that so much. It's so good. God, Event Horizon took us some places, you know, which I figured it would because it holds a special place.
Time and space and, you know, you can leap to big tangents from Event Horizon.
That's right. Well, like at the fastest point between two points in space is a tangent. I don't know if you knew, but yeah, if you just fold space and time in between the two and you just poke a pencil through it, it becomes a... Sorry, that makes no sense if you didn't recently watch Event Horizon, but that is how Weir explains how the gravity drive works in his...
Is it pretty effective? Oh, here's a closing question. So what do you think happens at the end? Because
Yeah.
So the movie closes with, you know, three of the characters getting off. They blow the rest of the ship, destroying the gravity drive.
Yeah, Miller sacrifices himself. It's a big, hero's ending.
That fight scene, though, an ultimate demon from another dimension gets into a fucking fist fight with him. Like, I mean, it's good.
Yeah.
Like, it's good in a way that I was like, this is terrible.
Yeah.
But like, this is what they can see for like the final act of the film is that like the ultimate transdimensional demon is going to get in a fist fight with Lawrence Fisher. Fine, whatever.
Not to go off on a tangent, I'll make it very brief, but
please,
I saw that as like, this thing feeds on suffering, and that's the way he was going to suffer the most, was like seeing his dead friend, and it kind of comes back, and it's like a whole, I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much.
And then he punches him?
Yeah.
And then he tries to beat him with a steel pipe or whatever? It's fine. I love it. Like, I don't want it any other way. Like, I don't want a better version of this movie. I'm fine with where it landed.
That was his ultimate suffering, was, like, being in a fist fight with a fucked up
demon. Well, he came out ahead.
Yeah, right.
So he sacrificed himself. He blows that side of the ship. They get into sort of a lifeboat that they are able to launch off, kind of, I guess, steer themselves towards Earth, go into cryo sleep. And then hope that their SOS is picked up by somebody and they get rescued. And so the movie cuts to them getting rescued, but one of the characters wakes up and one of the soldiers says, "Oh, we're here, everything's fine." Open the mask and it's it's Weir, it's Sam Neill, and he's like, "I've got all your friends." And then snap, she wakes up and, it's revealed that, she's just had some sort of nightmare. But then immediately after that, like the doors to the ship sort of like ominously close, sort of like leaving like the question open on what happened. Like my read is that they did safely escape, but that there's reason to think like their friends that got, because you clearly see them sucked into the wormhole.
Yeah.
That like maybe they're not doing so well on the other side and maybe are in for eternal torment. Because clearly whatever these transdimensional beings can do, whether it, Weir gets sucked out a window and then his body is returned. Like they have some sort of power that, is whatever. But clearly have the ability to manipulate beyond like the normal confines of sort of like life and death for the human body. So theoretically they're over there and things aren't going well. That was my read-in. I was curious what you thought.
Yeah. I really like that. It definitely struck me as like a very, it's a Freddy Krueger kind of homage a little bit of like, a semi-happy ending and then, kind of rip that away from you because it's just like, we're going to be that kind of schlocky horror movie. But I do really like that. I mean, you could interpret it as like, this is Stark kind of having a mental breakdown, possibly, after everything she just survived. We don't have enough about her character, though, to kind of go off of that. Like, she seems like she's holding it together better than most people pretty much the whole movie. Even when bad things happen to her, she's kind of the one who's like a little chill and a little more removed from a lot of things. She does suffer a lot of head injuries at the end. Like, she gets knocked on her head a lot, more so than maybe anybody else. Like, if there's a head trauma count in this movie, it is very high. It is like extremely high. I really like that. I like that, like, things aren't going so hot. They went to the other side and it's not going so great for them. It's kind of in keeping with the tone of the movie. I do like that. And then, of course, the end credits are over a Prodigy song, which is chef's kiss. For what this is and for what era this came from, it's like, okay, all right, good job. Go make Resident Evil,
Well, I mean, Mortal Kombat was also, that's just
the breakdown.
That's just Paul Anderson's shtick. Yeah. I think Orbital did the soundtrack to Event Horizon, I believe,
did
as well.
Really?
Or
that's
something
amazing.
Like that.
Yeah.
I want to say that's true.
I know. I'm, like, Maybe Googling not. It right now.
I know I saw something related to to Orbital. Maybe it was just the end.
Yeah, Michael Common in Orbital, it looks like, the score. Yeah. So, yeah,
yeah,
you're absolutely right.
Synthesizing sounds. Yeah. So, it was, yeah. So, and yeah, so, yeah, Mortal Kombat had a lot of that. I don't know if Resident Evil does. It's been a long time since I've seen. I only saw the first of Paul W.S. Anderson's Resident Evil, like, it's not even a quadrilogy. I think there were six of those movies.
Yeah, there were
no. I don't even know what the ilogy is on that at that point. But man, the dude loves his dance music. So
yeah,
sure. And then Mortal Kombat, the music is worth it. So
oh, absolutely,
it's fine with me.
100%, hard agree. I would as my closing thought, I would absolutely recommend Event Horizon for any folks who have any love for any of the things we've listed here. I think it holds up so much better than I thought it did, or was kind of worried it would. Just so many lovely touches from that era that are so very nostalgic for me, having been a very, very, very young teenager in the year of the birth of Event Horizon, the year we all went past the Event Horizon. Very, very good stuff. Patrick, do you have any other closing thoughts on this beautiful film?
Nah, as someone that doesn't collect things, like,
sure.
I'm a big believer. Like, I was Marie Kondo before that became popular. I like getting rid of stuff.
yeah.
But as I've gotten a little older and I have a house and I sort of had, like, more room for things. And so I'm, like, a little more thoughtful on, like, well, okay, if I wanted to have stuff, physical things, like, you know, what do I want? And so my wife and I recently purged, like, the vast majority of, like, the DVDs and Blu-rays that we owned and was like, okay, let's just keep the stuff that's really important to us. But I do want specifically, like, I want to replicate the idea of going to, like, a like when we met, or, like, obviously, as you talked about, like, going to a Blockbuster or going to, like, a homegrown movie store, which has, like, a heavily curated selection of just, like, really good shit. And so I have like this bookshelf, that's been full of DVDs that can, you know, probably fit a couple of hundred. Mm-hmm. It's like my plan over X number of years, you know, is to fill that with, like, a similar, like, massive collection. And so when I rewatch films, like, I normally just, you know, pay $4 to rent them on iTunes, but now I've been, like, watching sales and, like, trying to, like, slowly pick up on things. That's why I bought The Happening. It's like, yeah, this is a movie I want to hand to people and be like, go watch The Happening, or we're going to watch The Happening right now.
Yeah.
And after watching Event Horizon, like, I went and checked the Blu-ray and click, because that is one that holds up, that in, you know, a year or two, I will definitely want to revisit again.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. I think that's a really good standard to have, like, a shelf, or a virtual video store. Sort of, like, be good, rewatch it, has a little canon of, like, yeah, this one is,
excuse me?
This is worthwhile.
Excuse me?
A canon?
Be good, rewatch it?
Excuse me, pardon me. Pardon me, sir. Be good and...
Thank you.
Rewatch
we'll
it as its own shelf. And don't worry, we'll make sure there's an and on the shelf. We'll make sure there's an and on that shelf. I'll be positive to keep that one on there. Oh, my God. Patrick, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Where can people find you online?
You can find me at Patrick Klopik.
Amazing. You can find me at Danielle R.I., where I talk a lot about the horror movies I'm obsessed with at the moment. As always, our thanks to Too Mellow for our theme music. You can find that at toomellowmakes.bandcamp.com. Follow him at MellowMakes on Twitter. Of course, you can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice, and we're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. Thank you so much for listening to Be Good and Rewatch It.
We did.
If you enjoy this and any other episodes of Waypoint's many fine podcasts, please rate and review this podcast on the iTunes Store or wherever you listen, because it really does help. So for Patrick Klepek, this is Danielle Riendo signing out with, we're leaving.
Fuck this shit. Why does this stuff always happen to me?
Oh, baby bear.
Hold up. Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.